I don't know if this is a quorum or not. I don't know. We can officially meet, but we'll try. We'll try. So, I thought we would. Good morning.
Hey.
Good morning. I thought we'd start just doing a quick read through Romans 13. That's kind of in the area of generally where we left off last time. Not exactly, but somewhere in there. And just go through a couple of questions to kind of set our perspective. So I'll read, this is Romans 13, 1 through 7. It's in the handout on page 9, and then I'll talk about some questions. Every person is to be in subjection to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. Therefore, whoever resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God, and they who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. For rulers are not a cause of fear for good behavior, but for evil. Do you want to have no fear of authority? Do what is good, and you'll have praise from the same, for it is a minister of God to you for good. But if you do what is evil, be afraid, for it does not bear the sword for nothing. For it is a minister of God, an avenger, who brings wrath on the one who practices evil. Therefore, it's necessary to be in subjection, not only because of wrath, but also for conscience' sake. For because of this, you also pay taxes. For rulers are servants of God, devoting themselves to this very thing. Render to all what is due them, tax to whom tax is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. Morning, Seth.
Morning.
So a little context, right? Who wrote this?
Paul.
Yeah, we get some easy ones out of the way first. And what government was he living under?
Roman.
The Roman. Yeah, that's a good clue in the book title, right? It's written to the Romans. So they're in the Roman Empire. He's talking about living under their authorities, those authorities that are put over them. And verse 1, he talks about, right, who established them as the authority.
God.
Yeah, so we see God establishes the governing authorities, regardless of whether those authorities are practicing good or evil. God is the one who's established that authority. And what do we get as a description as the purpose, right? What's the role? So, like in verse 3, he talks a little bit about the role of the government or the governing authorities.
Punish bad behavior?
Restrain
evil.
Restrain evil? Yeah. And so, you know, there's a lot of people that will go to this text for lots of different application. Okay, this is what the government should be. This is what the government should be. So we're kind of focusing mainly our attention on capital punishment. That's been our topic. We're in the Christian ethics. All right. Why should workers of wickedness fear, right? Why should they fear the government? Is there a description in there? What's it say?
They are the ones to bear the sword.
Yeah. The government bears the sword, right? And they don't bear it in vain, right? Meaning it's not just an idle threat.
And it's the minister of God, so it's like the way God carries out. I mean, he could strike those people dead, but he uses the government.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not... It's not just that they fear the government, it's that they should fear, like, the government's acting on behalf of God, right? So they should fear the wrath of God as distributed kind of by the government. Oh, I did remember to start that. Okay. So we kind of talked about the sword is used for execution. It's a kind of symbolic word and literal. Here's a question. So is government obligated to practice capital punishment? Like, is it something that they can do or they must do? So there's kind of a slight difference there. What do you think looking at this passage? Something that they have the option to do, like they're doing it, and they did it in Rome and in the Empire.
Well,
which is something they're obligated to do.
At the time this was written, there probably wasn't a culture out there that didn't practice capital punishment.
So. Kind of foreign to even imagine. So it almost seems like he's explaining a fact that was taken for granted, that governments bear the sword, they punish wrongdoers. Why is that? Is that
to deter, you know, wrongdoing, evil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's an interesting part too. So when we talk about the ethics of it, we can talk about it as a deterrent, that it brings fear upon those who would act in an evil way, but it also is meant to just bring the wrath and the punishment due to someone, regardless of whether or not it deters someone else. We have a person that's guilty and deserving of that crime. I think last time we just spent a little bit of time going over what was a capital crime. So the Roman Empire had their own capital crimes, and then we talked about what the in the Mosaic Law, Old Testament, there's lots of capital crimes. Okay, so just in review, can you remember any of the capital crimes that maybe in the Old Testament that we don't have today?
Kidnapping.
There's some states that still hold that kidnapping can be punished with a capital crime. So I haven't done a ton of research, but the Supreme Court, you know, has upheld capital punishment, and there's a number of states that have either explicitly outlawed it in their state, and then there's a number that continue to practice it. And so the crimes that are punishable by capital as capital crimes vary slightly. Most of them are murder involving this, taking life involving this. Almost all of them involve taking life. But yeah, kidnapping was. What were some more from the Old Testament?
Adultery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that one's not. We don't see that in any of the states today. But at the time, and that was the example we talked about from the New Testament, that they brought the woman but not the man, right? They were kind of perverting the Mosaic code. Do you remember some of the more unusual ones too?
Cursing father and mother.
Man, I'd have a lot less students in class. Yeah, and kind of we talked about briefly, like, why if you're talking to someone about the capital crimes in the Old Testament, specifically the Mosaic Law, for the nation of Israel, why did God have different or more capital crimes? What was so important about the nation of Israel that they had these specific capital crimes that maybe were not before or not after? So, like the cursing of parents, or
they were supposed to be holy and supposed to different than other nations.
Mm-hmm.
So they had a higher standard, I guess.
Right, higher and just different. Like they had working on the Sabbath was a capital crime, and we read an account of a man that's out gathering wood on the Sabbath, and he was put to death for that. So they had a very different code, and one of the things we talked about was, not only was it because that person was sinning against and defying God's command, but it also was meant to, like you said, a deterrent to keep Israel from following that example and many more dying, because God had given specific warnings of plagues and famines and death that would come upon the nation if they were to disobey. So I don't know if we talked about this part last time. So today, I think this is where we ended, was what did we say was, like, if we are in favor of the death penalty today, what crimes should we and which should we not? Is there a scriptural precedence for? Should we include all of the Mosaic crimes? Should there just be a certain crimes that we still would be in favor of the death penalty? There's a couple passages outside of. Yeah. Yeah, so in Genesis 9, that was one of the biggest ones that we looked at, was right before the flood, God gives his condemnation of the wickedness of man, and his prime example is the violence that's being committed. And then after the flood, he gives this, you want to read that, Genesis 9, 5 and 6? It's in your handout earlier on, or you can flip there.
And for your lifeblood, I will require a reckoning from every beast. From every beast, I will require it, and from man. From his fellow man, I will require a reckoning for the life of man. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For God made man in his own image.
Yeah. So, and I was thinking about this today. I've been reading one of the drier parts for me. Is I'm in Leviticus now, you know, and it's just interesting, as I was thinking and reflecting on what we're teaching here, that every, he gives specific instruction, every sin, this is how it's to be atoned for, paid for. You bring a bull, you bring a goat, you bring two rams, you bring two doves. If you don't have that, you bring, you know, grain. And it's this sense that you get over and over and over, that sin requires something to atone for it. And so this is kind of that, this greatest sin we talked about, that when you kill a man, you're killing, in a sense, you're attacking the image of God. And so that punishment, he says, should be that your life shall be taken by man, right? He says, in that verse, whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. So, capital crimes, what do you think? What should be a capital crime? Should we still do kidnapping, for example, biblically? Or some of the other ones in many states, there was a time when rape was a capital crime. For many states, that's not anymore. I'm trying to see what else. So, treason, 1790, piracy, mutiny. Those were capital crimes. So, you know, some of the more recent ones, you know, like some of the, you know, like Timothy McVeigh and the Oklahoma City bombing, it's a capital crime. But what do we think biblically would be a good choice for?
For sure, murder.
For sure, murder. Yeah. Yeah. And so, I think that's where scripturally we have the strongest case. I don't know that you would have as an easy of a time to justify other crimes being capital punishment. We do see that there was quite a few other ones in the Old Testament, but those, again, were not under that Old Testament law. I was looking in the last 20 years, the number of executions, I think the high was in 2000 or 2001. There was 98 that year. So there's been quite a few since the mid-80s, varying from 20 to 25, from 85 to 90. From 90 to 95, they range from 25 to 50 a year. 95 to 2000, they shot from 50 to 100, and then there's been a gradual decline. From 2000 to 2005, they dropped from like 90 a year to about 52, and then 2010, about 40. So there's a lot of executions, but those are, there's some that are federal, and then a lot where there's in those states that are still practicing. Two of the main Supreme Court rulings have both been against Georgia. Georgia's a big capital punishment state.
be interesting to see what the murder rate has done, you know, since capital punishment has been going down, if it's been going up. And
right.
It seems like it is, especially lately.
Right. Yeah. Or to compare crime rates in capital punishment states versus non-states.
Yeah.
There's no difference. Let me get your homework. No, that'd be good. I'm good to go look that up. So, and we talked about how, I mean, in a sense, we're all under the death penalty physically. We're all going to die because of the curse of sin. And how, you know, that capital punishment can speed up or the lack of it can delay that punishment. So I think, you know, Dave said that his conclusion, and I would be pretty close to this on page 11, you know, that in Romans, Paul teaches that government, I'm on the page 11, that God used the government to execute his justice, and we see from before the Mosaic Code, during the Mosaic Code, and after the Mosaic Code, that capital punishment was a part of the government's authority. And I would say that primarily, you know, first degree murder would be your capital crime that you could defend capital punishment for. And the idea is that it's in a sense the most direct attack on the image of God, one of the most serious thing. You're robbing someone of their life, and that God requires the taking of your life in that place. And so now we just want to talk about some of the other ethics. Like, does that reconcile with, some people see a conflict between being supporting capital punishment in certain cases, but also being pro-life or against euthanasia, the taking of life of the unborn, or the taking of life of allowing someone or encouraging someone to take their own. So here's kind of a few thoughts about that on page 12. So, can one consistently argue that against abortion and euthanasia and espouse capital punishment? So here's at least three grounds at which you could do that. One would be sanctity of life, that you're demanded to treat all persons justly. So it deals with the justice of the taking of the life. A commitment to non-consequentialist ethics, so we'll talk about that in a second. Given the sanctity of life ethic, human life is sacred and is protected. So abortion and euthanasia are out because you're not protecting life, whereas execution of murders underscores that you're protecting the lives of those who have had their life taken by the murderers. As to justice, the unborn, the aged, and the infirm have done nothing deserving of death, whereas the convicted murderer has. So on a justice level, it demands rejecting abortion but executing murderers, because one is deserving and one is not. Finally, on the non-consequentialist theory, God prescribes the protection of the innocent and the punishment of those who take life. If one follows these commands, you have to reject. So I thought this was an interesting question, is can one consistently harmonize being against capital punishment, abortion, and euthanasia? So what would you think would be an argument if you're against all three? You're against abortion and euthanasia, but also against capital punishment.
Well, the thing that's all in common with all those is taking a person's life, and I suppose that would be consistent in that instance.
Yeah.
I think the big inconsistency would come if they were against capital punishment and pro-abortion.
Answer question C.
Yeah. And I see that.
Yeah.
That's a lot more common.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And have you ever thought about, or have you heard any arguments like why, explanation?
I think it's political. I mean, it's kind of a narrative, and people just kind of believe that, oh, it's okay to kill a baby, you know.
Right.
It doesn't make any sense, but somehow they just say that it's the woman's right, you know. Mm-hmm. And they explain it away by that.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty much the big thing, is they explain it's the woman's right, and then they'll turn around and say, well, that life has value still of the murderer.
Yeah,
so the value of life.
They're saying that there's value of life over here, but saying there's no value mm-hmm. of life over here, mm-hmm. even though that life hasn't even had a chance to begin.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and it does come back to what determines the value of a life. We talked about this. So a person that holds that view has a very different definition as to what gives life its value, right? So think about what is maybe a convicted criminal, somebody on death row, what do they have that an unborn or someone who is in a position that they would desire suicide or euthanasia, what difference might they give? Why might they give value to someone in one position and not in the other?
Baby versus criminal, like, you know, you're talking baby is incapable of, you know, higher order thinking, reason.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then you can make the same argument, maybe even with the infirm for euthanasia, that they're, you know, at least in some cases, no longer capable of that
mm-hmm.
kind of thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, for when you remove the foundation that being in the image of God is what gives life its value, that human life is valuable, if we're another animal, etc., it's our experiences, our ability to think and reason and interact that gives life its value.
Contribute to society.
I'm not sure about the contribution to society of the death row inmate. But I do see that in their argument there's this strain of consistency in that they believe that if the person is able to operate as an individual, thinking, feeling, interacting, that's what gives them value to their life, regardless of how evil or good they are. And they don't see that in an unborn, or sometimes in someone who's suffering or has lost their ability to think, to reason, to speak, to remember. And so that's coming from a totally different place is what gives life its value in that sense. And so if you're having a discussion, right, talking about policy doesn't matter until we kind of talk about what gives life its value.
You know, the same people that are pro-abortion, you know, they would, like, if you had an endangered species of an animal that was pregnant and terminated their pregnancy, they'd get upset, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Yeah, and it's very complicated, and I think sometimes we have to be careful not to assume too much and oversimplify what is going on in someone's mind that has these views, because we're so good at lying to ourselves that it can be very complex in terms of why a person rationalizes a certain belief, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And so I talked to some that talk about how they believe abortion is wrong, but they believe that that's the medical choice between the person and it shouldn't be a governmental. So there's all these little different things that they allow them to take one political stand and feel like they're taking the opposite moral stand and reconcile those things.
There'd be a common thread that people that believe in evolution,
mm-hmm.
I think they would believe it's okay to have abortions.
Yeah.
Because we're just
very much
basically for animals, we just
mm-hmm.
a little bit higher level of evolution than animals.
Yeah, there's genetic material.
Yeah.
Yeah, very much so. And a couple of thought questions. So, you know, when you think about it, there's many things that we see in Christian ethics that kind of reflect something about God's character. Okay, so when we talked about, you know, we talked about abortion, we talked about his valuing of life, that he values and views human life as precious, it's in its image. So is there something different that capital punishment can reflect of his character or his nature? Talk about why we would be in favor of it, because God is what?
Just.
He's a just God. Right, punishes the wicked. Anything else? I think part of that justice, too, is that we can also be in favor of a... We can work, instead of working to oppose capital punishment, we can work in favor of reform or the most just system that's possible. So, for example, the account that we talked about with Jesus, you know, he wasn't going to endorse this unjust execution. It's kind of a mob lynching or a, you know, we're going to execute this person without a trial, without a chance of appeal, without witnesses. So the justice part, you can argue for reform of capital punishment at the same time that you're in favor of it.
That was a woman caught in adultery.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? The man wasn't brought before. There's no mention of who the witnesses are testifying mm-hmm. on mm-hmm. what happened. It's just a big mob kind of brings her in and says, she's guilty.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Stoning, that'd be pretty severe. I mean, it's not a quick death.
Right. Right. And, you know, like Paul was stoned and he survived.
Yeah.
So it's not always 100%. You know, it's interesting looking at capital punishment. There's been botched, a lot of botched executions over the years where it's supposed to be quick and it takes hours. So that's what I'm talking about with reform, yeah.
Recently happened in Oklahoma, and that's why Oklahoma has no lethal injections right now, because they're trying to make sure they get everything right
before
they allow them to start back up.
Yeah, and there's a number of states that are kind of in between where capital punishment is on the books, but they've declared we're not going to do any until they've kind of worked out. So it's like legally possible, but there haven't been any for, say, 10 years, 15 years. There's a number of states that are kind of in that position.
And I always want to tread lightly with capital punishment, my personal feelings.
Mm-hmm.
I believe in appeals
mm-hmm.
firmly, because what if this person didn't do
exactly?
That? We've got
exactly.
to go through
every possible
avenue
mm-hmm.
and make sure, because I don't want to send someone that's innocent
mm-hmm.
to that. There's
yeah.
Nah.
One of the things that the Supreme Court ruled upon when it outlawed capital punishment for a time was the fact that there was a time when the And when a person was convicted, the jury had to make two decisions. One, are they guilty or not? And if they are guilty, do they deserve the death penalty or not? And so it created somewhat of a disparity of results. So often white criminals who were convicted of a similar case were not given the death penalty, and black criminals who were convicted of a similar case were given the death penalty. So it was an unjust distribution of the crime. Or the punishment didn't always fit the crime, if that makes sense. So there's kind of disparities there. So there's a lot of work to be done, for sure. And I think that some people oppose death penalty on those grounds alone, that yes, it's just and should be done if it can be done right, and then their case would be we just can't. Humans are so incapable of... So it's kind of reasoning from the sinfulness of man, but kind of pushing aside the fact that Paul seemed to acknowledge it without any qualms, even when I don't think they had the legal protections that we do today. So even though we're better off there, we can still fight for a better system. I don't know if you guys remember, and I didn't do research, but I remember reading the account in a book of Ted Bundy. You heard of Ted Bundy? He was in right, mass murder, killed several, mostly young women, if I'm correct.
Mm-hmm. Killed about over 30.
Yeah. And so was convicted.
Yes.
I believe he confessed at some point.
A long way.
Right before, there. Right, not during. And I think that one of the accounts that's interesting is that very close to the execution date, he had a purported confession of faith. Okay, and did an interview, and so the question that David Clues said, so he just says, let's say a mass murder, or you could think of Ted Bundy, right? So They're sent to death shortly before executed. Goes out, undergoes a genuine conversion. Should this transformation have any bearing? What do you think? Should it affect?
No.
Well, someone could fake it and say, yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
No.
So.
I mean, he did the crime.
I mean, legally, probably not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I got a feeling, though, if he was truly converted, he's probably more than likely going to be okay with with going through with it.
Yeah.
Because he's going to know what he did, and because he knows what he did, he's going to be like, yeah.
It's been a while since I read the account. It's probably been 15 years or more. But from what I remember, that short time right close to the execution, he acknowledged that he was guilty and that he deserved that punishment. And so he would kind of agree that, yeah, it doesn't change anything in that sense. I think the hard part for us is not just necessarily the administering the death penalty, but I think when we talk about understanding salvation by grace, to actually believe that, well, Ted Bundy might be in heaven.
I know.
Isn't that, I mean, it kind of grates against our...
At the same time, it should give you some hope. Even Ted Bundy can go to heaven.
So. Yeah, I think in my case, it just really shows my own self-righteousness. Well, God can forgive me, but shouldn't forgive Ted Bundy because he's so much worse than I am.
Kind of thinking about this in a different way, like even as believers, if we commit some kind of sin, you know, and you know, if we are... subject to legal repercussions, we don't get out of those legal repercussions just because we're believers.
Yeah.
It's like in the Romans 13 passage that we mentioned a second ago.
Mm-hmm.
I look at it. Something along the lines of you should fear rulers because they bear the sword, so there's really no point for them not to bear the sword if a believer had committed crime.
Exactly. There's no exclusion clause for you. And I think that's interesting. Let's look at one more passage in Acts 25. So Paul's on trial. All the Jews, many of the Jews are trying to kill him, right? They want him to be transported from one place to the other so that they can get an ambush.
You said Acts what?
Acts chapter 25. Okay. And I'll start in verse 3. We'll read down to probably verse 11. So, asking as a favor against Paul that he summon him to Jerusalem, because they were planning an ambush to kill him on the way. Festus replied that Paul was being kept at Caesarea, and that he himself intended to go there shortly. So, said he, let the man of authority among you go down with me, and if there is anything wrong about the man, let them bring charges against him. So we kind of see this, even back then, just like today, some would rush to execute those who they seem are worthy of death, right? Just as the mob did with Christ. After he stayed among them not more than 8 or 10 days, he went down to Caesarea, and the next day he took his seat on the tribunal and ordered Paul to be brought. When he had arrived, the Jews who had come down from Jerusalem stood around him, bringing many and serious charges against him that they could not prove. Paul argued in his defense, neither against the law of the Jews, nor against the temple, nor against Caesar have I committed any offense. But Festus, wishing to do the Jews a favor, said to Paul, do you wish to go up to Jerusalem and there be tried on these charges before me? But Paul said, I am standing before Caesar's tribunal, where I ought to be tried. To the Jews I have done no wrong, as you yourself know very well. If then I am a wrongdoer and have committed anything for which I deserve to die, I do not seek to escape death. But if there is nothing to their charges against me, no one can give me up to them, I appeal to Caesar. So we see a couple of great things. We see the appeals process, right? Paul's on trial, they want to execute him, he makes his appeal to the higher court. So we have a lot of precedence that, yes, we should allow an appeals process there. It saved Paul's life, in a sense. right? So they want to go to Jerusalem. He says, no, I want to go to Rome and appeal to Caesar. But he says there in verse 11, what does he say that's kind of significant?
If he did anything wrong, then he said, I'm not going to try to escape death if I did something wrong.
Exactly. If I've done something deserving of death, I'm not going to try to escape death. And so, you know, that applies to a lot of things in the sense that he acknowledges that if you've done a crime worthy of death, that you should receive the punishment, and that goes for believers as well, right? So it doesn't really matter. So I think, question D here, kind of on that last page, why do you suppose our culture is moving away from the practice of capital punishment? What assumptions about human nature might erode? And this could be about humans or about God.
Yeah. Non-believers will say that man is basically good, and they don't believe in good and evil, I guess.
Yeah.
That may be a basic reason why.
Yeah, and when you talk about, I always kind of have this picture in my mind, right, that when we have God in view, we see that how man is, we're all sinful, in a sense, we're all so far below. And when there's no God, like in Ecclesiastes, where it's just what you see under the sun, just on the earth, there's such a narrow difference between a good person and a bad person that they'll say, how can we as men that make all these mistakes and have all of our prejudices condemn this person, and they'll kind of lower the morality of this and raise the morality of this to where they're so close in their mind it doesn't make sense why we're gonna put them to death, and are we that much better than them? And there's such a thin scope of morality. That's definitely true. I think there's also something to, if they're worthy of death, kind of makes us feel a little uncomfortable. Like, oh, am I that much better? Like, it reminds us of our mortality. Not just that we're going to die, but that God does execute wrath, and that's a very unpopular.
It seems like today's age that we're living in, it's the biggest sin is being intolerant.
Mm-hmm.
Our society wants to be tolerant of everything, and it seems like criminals are getting away with a lot more now, and because it's intolerant mm-hmm. to punish anything.
Yeah, everyone wants to do what's right in their own eyes,
mm-hmm.
and so it's an interesting swing because, if a culture is adhering to a moral standard and people are wanting to live in disobedience to that, the first thing that they'll do is kind of say, well, there's no moral right and wrong, until they kind of get to where the society generally accepts that. And then once there's like, oh, there's no moral right and wrong, then it starts to add back in the moral right and wrong. And like you're saying, then it becomes very evil to say something's wrong, to say something's good, right? So it's kind of a replacement. If we can get this morality out, right, we always fill that vacuum mm-hmm. with another one. And so, some examples of that, I think, is that if you go back 30 years maybe, in general, the public viewed homosexuality as a sinful or immoral behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a time where the argument was there's not an absolute sexual ethic, and so although we disagree with it, don't think it's right, we shouldn't have place to tell someone that they can't do that. And so as that grew and that philosophy grew, it was tolerance, tolerance, tolerance. And then once it was tolerated by many, then it became, now it's evil to have any other opinion or to say mm-hmm. or to mention or to hint at that it might not be a moral behavior. So it was a changing, a replacement, I guess.
Same with the transgender thing, and
mm-hmm.
marriage.
Yep.
You go down that path, and there's just where you stop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's, you know, I'm encouraged because we have this, the testimony of Scripture, and we see that many, many times, right? The cycle just repeats and repeats and repeats in different countries and different contexts, right? Man is in a place of prosperity and needs not to fear God and goes down all these paths of sin, and they see judgment and they see, you know, the consequences of it, and then oftentimes there's a portion that turns back to God, and God brings a blessing from following him, and then that, you know, starts over again. So we're always at different parts of that cycle. I think the conclusion would be that, you know, when we think about capital punishment, we have to be careful when we say that we support it, because there's a lot of ways that it would be ungodly to carry it out, right? There's a lot of ways that we could be misused or done poorly. We see that in the Scripture. And so we, although we are in favor of it, we also want to be in favor of it being done justly, that the punishment fits the crime, that we're not in favor of capital punishment for petty theft, etc., those type of things. It's the right punishment for the right crime, that we're in favor of. We have to be beyond a reasonable doubt, you know, that has to be, you know, almost a virtual certainty of their guilt. There has to be an appeals process and many of those things in place.
I suppose the extreme to our country would be, you know, some communist country where people just live in fear of government. From, if you did anything wrong, you just
executed.
Just, yeah, get executed, disappear.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So you can see how that, you know, that the heart of a lot of these issues is more about man has a heart that's been changed, and if not, the wickedness of man can be carried out by the murderers, but also by those that are in power in abuse of that capital punishment. And it's a great reminder that the gospel is really the only kind of solution, and that a lot of these crimes are more at restraining, holding back some of that evil, but not really curing or creating a change of the heart in someone. I'm trying to remember which states. I don't remember exactly which states, but it kind of looked like on the map, it was basically everything south and east of Kansas. Those were the capital punishment states. And the northeast and the west coast, northwest, were where it was outlawed explicitly. And then kind of in those borders, kind of mixed in, were states that it was still on the books, but hadn't been carried out in terms of state punishment by the state. And then, of course, there was federal, which was just, there were certain federal capital crimes.
I wonder why that would be.
Does Kansas have it?
Yeah. So, when I looked at Kansas, it was, there had not been any, but it was still, like, it had not been outlawed. So, it's like, so pragmatically, there wasn't capital punishment, even though you could, but we just haven't carried one out in a long time.
So is it the state that you commit the crime, or where you're, how's that word?
Yeah, it's, so if, from what I understand, is that where the crime is committed is generally where the criminal should be tried. So if they catch them in Oklahoma for a murder in Texas, they get sent back to Texas to be tried in that state. If I believe, if I'm correct. So let me see. Okay, let's see if I got it. So I've got kind of a skewed map here. States within it without the death penalty. So, right, the red, legally, they have death penalty. And then, what is it, I'm just moving the map now. The
light blue is no death penalty at all. And I'm in South America.
So this particular site isn't talking about the ones that has just haven't practiced it in a long time. So these light blue along the top, East Coast, and then here in Colorado and New Mexico, there, or Arizona.
So they don't have laws?
They don't. It's illegal. Okay. No death penalty. And then purple, it's listed as a governor-imposed moratorium. So we're not going to, even if they're convicted, the executive branch, which carries out the punishment, is not going to assign. And some of these, a lot of these, on another map I saw, these red states kind of here. It's like there's no moratorium. It's just they've not actually carried one out for a long time. And I think that, you know.
So does Kansas have inmates that are on death row?
I believe so. Yeah, I believe so. I may have to look at the all-knowing source of Wikipedia. I wonder when the last execution in Kansas. '65, 1965.
Really?
So it's been a while for Kansas.
I think Terry Nichols was from Kansas, and he was executed, wasn't he?
Yeah, and I wonder if it was tried under federal or state. You know what I mean? Like, it could be that they are from Kansas, but they were tried under the federal death penalty.
Yeah.
And it could have been carried out. So, from what I remember, there's like, I think it's Terre Haute, Indiana, is like the federal death row prison that carries out where all the executions go, so they get taken. That's where they're at. But there was a lot of data that I was like, oh, no way I'm gonna be able to go over just the. It's just all the states, you know, went through different process. There's Supreme Court rulings back and forth about, like the constitutionality of the